originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. As always, Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, and Jude Feld, Pontiff of the Pick Four, together with you in our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios right here in the heart of the Bluegrass, Lexington, Kentucky. Want to welcome everybody tuning in throughout North America on Sirius 219 XM Channel 206, and those of you streaming us worldwide at horseracingradio.net. Welcome to the program here tonight, and we have yet another special show over the course of the next hour. We'll tell you about that shortly. But JT, before we dive into the subject matter of tonight's Trainer Talk show, we want to give a little plug to our sponsor of this show, Fasig Tipton. They have a big event coming up in Florida. It is the Florida Sale, the two-year-old in training sale, coming up on Wednesday, March 1st. It begins at 4 p.m. that day. The Under Tack Show, the preview day, is going to be Monday, February 27th at 10 a.m. And you and I have been there for that sale. It's a sale that produced Kentucky Derby winner Nyquist last year. Look, this is a top-notch sale, and we would encourage everybody to make their plans to be there.
Yeah, a lot of nice horses go through that sale. It's a source of plenty of stakes winners, and always a good sale to attend.
You remember Nyquist got that big bonus, too, for winning the Florida Derby and then taking the Kentucky Derby?
Just an extra million, but who's counting?
Yeah, who's at that point? Well, I would be counting. I know that. All right, well, I told you it's a special show here tonight, and every week we have the privilege of visiting with so many of the people that make this sport a success. Tonight, certainly no exception. Tonight's guest was born the son of a rancher in Oklahoma in 1937, and like many families during that era, his family didn't have a lot of money, so he began working with quarter horses before eventually switching to thoroughbreds in 1975. He saddled 277 winners over a 10-year span from 1979 to 1989, including Uncool, winner of the 1980 Oaklawn Handicap. These days, he's probably better known as Todd Pletcher's dad, and that's just fine with him. Please welcome J.J. Pletcher to the program here tonight. J.J., welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be on.
Happy to have you on board, and congratulations on all of your success and certainly on the success of your son. You must be extremely proud.
Yes, he was the only child, so he was jerked up around the racetrack. He learned it the hard way.
Well, as a father, forget about as a fellow horseman, as a father, what's it been like to watch Todd's career unfold?
You know, it's easy to say. Everybody talks about this, that, and the other about their children, but anybody could have raised him. He was a perfect child. I'm not bragging about him. He was interested in the horse game, started riding horses at 6 years old. And where I was at the time, he was six with New Mexico, and you could have your pony on the backside for your kids. You could do whatever you wanted to, you know. They could come back there and go there. They could do everything but go to the grandstand. Believe it or not, you couldn't go to the grandstand in New Mexico, Oaklawn, or anywhere else till about, close to the 80s, I guess.
Yeah,
I remember, but
keeping kids off the track is kind of a strange way to improve your business, but a lot of tracks had those rules, and even against women on the backside. I remember when I started training, my wife had to get a trainer's wife badge. She wasn't allowed on the backside of Santa Anita till
really
after 7 o'clock. Yeah, after 7 o'clock, no women on the backside. Try to get away with that today.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, that's a long time ago.
Well, JJ. Todd didn't have any problem hanging out on the backside, though. I know he was with you very often around the barn areas, and if I remember correctly, he was a pretty good Pac-Man player, too, wasn't he?
He was an expert on Pac-Man, and he was pretty good at playing racehorse rummy in the kitchen at Oak Lawn Park when he was 12 years old. That made me get him out of there.
He's the only guy been 86 from the Oak Lawn kitchen?
Yeah.
Yeah, I read some
racehorse rummy for about 20 cents a point. You know, it was $10, $20 the most you could lose, but he was an expert at that.
So he always had that will to win, even as a young kid like that.
He would throw a fit and tear up the card once in a while.
Well, I read somewhere that he actually had the high score at so many of the Pac-Man games that were in the track kitchens around the country. Everywhere you would go, he would seem to find a Pac-Man game, and he held the high score at most of those tracks. Is that true?
That's absolutely true. I have to go get him when I was in Rio Doce, and he was about, 7 or 8. He'd have to help walk horses, and I'd have to go get him out of the kitchen every once in a while. And horses coming back from the track. But have to run to the kitchen to get him.
A little different work ethic now, huh? He's like 100% all in every day.
He's a workaholic now.
JJ, did you know right from the beginning that Todd was destined to be involved with thoroughbred racing?
He was an absolute natural. He started out reading the form in his first, second grade, and I had some clients, and when they'd come to the races, he'd, take the form and tell them who he liked, and they'd bet him $6 or something, and he started doing that at an early age. I don't remember exactly what, but pretty early.
He's always been an entrepreneur, huh?
Yeah.
Talking with J.J. Pletcher here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. J.J., you mentioned Todd riding at a young age, and if I recall, he actually started out very, very young wanting to be a jockey and would actually practice in your Cadillac. Is that right?
Yeah, he'd ride that, the drop-down cushion there in the front seat, ride that. Oh. Carry a stick with him most of the time.
It's kind of hard to picture now, but must have been pretty cute.
When you start to pass the car, he'd go to riding, and he'd get mad if you. I'd back up there once while just to make stir him up a little.
Tell me, he got stopped, huh?
Wouldn't go and pass the car. But he probably went to. We was racing at that time, running from Sullen Park in the wintertime, Rio Doce in the summer, to Centennial Park at the old Centennial Park in Denver, Littleton, Colorado, and then, doing a lot of traveling, La Mesa Park. Gosh, went to every racetrack around there trying to make a living some way.
What's your favorite story? Every dad likes to brag on their son. My father did the same thing. What's your favorite story to tell people about Todd as he was a young man growing up and getting started with horse racing?
Oh, gosh, I can't come up right now. I can't think of anything other than he was, got out of high school. I went to California in the early 70s for about 3 years, and I got to be good friends with Henry Marino and Warren and Mel Studi and those guys. So in the summertime, I sent Todd to Del Mar 1 year. I think he was just either his senior year or just getting out of high school. Stayed the summer there with Henry. Done him a lot of good. Henry was an outgoing guy, and a lot of fun to be around. He kind of got him out where he wasn't introverted or anything. He was he'd have to talk to everybody. And then he worked for one summer. He worked for Wayne at Chicago under Brandy Bradshaw, I believe it was. And then the next summer he worked for Charlie Whittingham at Hollywood Park one summer. That's while he's in college. He went to the University of Arizona, and good background, you know, there. When he got out of college, he went to work for Wayne, and well, I say Wayne, he actually flew. He and I drove nonstop from Arkansas to New York, and he went to work for Jeff. You know, I worked for Jeff actually until Jeff got hurt in New York. Stayed up there, and then in the wintertime he stayed there working for Karen McLaughlin. You know, Karen stayed there in the winter and stayed there a winter or two. So he had a great background and been around good horsemen, good trainers, and good work ethics.
How difficult was it to raise a son when you're traveling from track to track like that?
Probably the good thing of it was you just had one. I don't know what I had three or four kids. Probably couldn't have made it. I'd probably, no telling what would happen. But one, you kind of adjust. And he went to school, one in El Paso, 3 years, I think, in grade school. There was a lot of... I always said he claimed the fame back then. He was in school with Tuff Hedeman. You know who Tuff Hedeman was? World champion bull rider, you know?
Oh, started wow.
PBR and all of that. So there's a lot of background there to do with the horse industry, you know. In fact, Tuff Hedeman's dad was a horse dentist and done my dental work for years. So they all come out of a pretty good group of boys come out of there. Mike Smith was about that time come along. I helped him get started. And the first year he came to Oaklawn, I put him on a horse called Bye Bye Shecky. He went three in a row on it. Every time I see Mike to this day, he'll holler at me, Bye Bye Shecky. And that many years ago. At least 30, I would guess.
JJ, did you know Mike was as talented as he's turned out to be when you were giving him a leg up that day?
Oh, yeah. I was in Louisiana Downs when he was 15 years old. When he come down, him and another boy come down there, son of a groom that I had that used to work for me. Come down there, and he wanted me to help him get started riding. I said, Mike, my God, you're 15. You got to wait a while, and you need to put on some weight. You didn't weigh 100 pounds then. And he went back to New Mexico, and then P.K. Young took his book and took him to Nebraska and around. He come to Oaklawn that winter. I can't remember what year that was, a long time ago. Yeah, I know Mike many, many years. He come out of El Paso.
Well, he seems to have the same kind of work ethic that Todd does. I mean, these are guys that they get up every morning, do their job. Mike Smith takes impeccable care of himself. He's in his 50s. He's riding like he's in his 20s. Is that a kind of a New Mexico thing?
I would guess, it was tough to make a living back then. You had to be out there early. You had to, like Mike and them boys, they had to gallop horses. They didn't only ride. You just didn't go out there to breeze a horse. They put you on one, save that $5 for gallop boy, you know?
Yeah, every penny counts on the smaller racetracks when the purses aren't very big and the opportunities aren't there.
That's right.
JJ, obviously you didn't shy away from Todd being involved in the horse business. You encouraged him to be around you and your operation when you were training. How about your dad? I mentioned, you know, he was a rancher, also a minister. Would he encourage you to be involved with the horses the way you were?
No, I kind of came up, I had an uncle that was a calf roper. rodeo guy, and I helped him when I was, you know, I guess in 10, 11, 12, 13, long in there, practicing. We grew up on a wheat farm, and actually in the panhandle of Texas. And the farm in the summer and winter, and rodeo, and, you know, I'd turn calves loose and help him practice roping all the time. It's kind of where I got interested in the quarter horse deal. Then when we moved to Texas, I started making those county fairs down there in the early 60s with quarter horses, and that's got over into, finally went to Red Doses first, I think it was 69's first year I went up there.
Yeah, tell me about those early days when you're working with those quarter horses and you're doing it on those small farm circuits. Many of the races, I'm sure, weren't even sanctioned. What was that like, cutting your teeth on that circuit?
That was tough. You did your own, you had to do your own grooming and walking and riding and everything else. You did it all. Had a four-horse trailer and a pickup and make all those all around South Texas. I did that for 2 or 3 years. I think 62 was the first year, 63, 64, long in there.
Did you have to do anything else in the meantime to help support yourself?
Oh, you would, I'd done a little of everything. Tried to run a little old store a little bit and on the side and done different things, anything you can do. That's down there in the hill country, South Texas, and it wasn't much money floating around down there. Didn't have any big owners like you do now.
You know, you mentioned being around the rodeo too. Did you ever have an opportunity to go and watch Carl Nafsker when he was riding bulls?
No, the first year I met Carl was at 1973 at Santa Fe. They opened up Santa Fe, and Carl and I were stabled right next to each other. And that's maybe the first year he trained. And I was an old hand at it. I'd been training 2 or 3 years then. And we got to be good friends. In fact, Carl left, go somewhere, to probably the rodeo or something, left a horse or two with me. That's been a long time ago.
Well, he was one heck of a bull rider. I mean, Hall of Fame bull rider.
Yeah, they come along. He come up the hard way, too. They were the real cowboys. They weren't just drugstore cowboys. They knew what, when they said something, they knew it.
JJ, what led you to eventually shift from quarter horses and getting involved with thoroughbreds?
The last year I was in New Mexico, let's see, 75, I won the Kansas Futurity, which was one leg of the quarter horse triple crown with a horse called Chick's Deck. And I was switching. I had thoroughbreds along then. I'd already won the Red Ocean Futurity, which was a $50,000 race. That was big time. We went to Keeneland and bought a horse for $4,200 to win that. Horse called the Reprobate. And then I started getting some two-year-old thoroughbreds to train, and then seven, I went every two-year-old race out there, $100,000 two-year-old races. I think one in Denver and Centennial Park, one at La Mesa Park, and one at Albuquerque. And then after that, I left and headed for Oaklawn and Axarbon and went on that circuit for a while.
You mentioned buying a horse at Keeneland for $4,200. Your eye for a horse has become legendary in the thoroughbred business. How much different is it looking at a quarter horse than a thoroughbred?
Not a whole lot, you know. You don't want that quite the muscling that you get in a quarter horse, but you got to have the balance and everything fit right, you know, and it's pretty close to the same if you get down to it, especially yearlings. You like a little substance to them, you know. We were looking for speed mostly, you know. I made Todd go into Keeneland with me all the time when he didn't even want to, you know. He didn't want to stand around out there and look at yearlings all the time, but I made him go because I probably learned more there than I did anywhere in the world, anywhere else in the horse industry. You learn more at making those sales and getting what the market's doing, how the owners are all there and all of that, and you learn a lot.
Well, that was really fortuitous for him that you made him go, because now that's a huge part of his business. He's at almost every sale checking horses out.
Yeah, you know, and you got to give Wayne credit for being the founder of all of that stuff, starting coming from the quarter horse industry to the thoroughbred industry and going to those sales and pumping that money up, you know. Shoot, he'd go there and to spend you know, got those guys going. He was an expert at it.
JJ, obviously you had a hand in picking out so many top horses that Todd has had the privilege to train. English Channel, More Than Ready, those horses come to mind. When you look at horses now, and when Todd looks at horses now, how much interaction is there between the two of you when you're selecting young horses?
You know, we're very close together. We see about the same thing in the horse, and usually we split up and we go to the Keeneland sale, and we'll take a barn and each, and we'll go through and shortlist them, and then meet back up, and three or four of us, whoever's on the committee that year, whoever it is, and then we go through them, and we're pretty close to the same. We're not too far off.
I know there's something. I know there's one horse that you guys weren't close on. It's a story that I love listening to Todd tell. He told it on our show here a few weeks ago. It was the story of English Channel and how you kept telling him, "I got this horse that's really, really nice." And so, you know, you keep plugging English Channel, and Todd finally shows up at the barn about 3 weeks later, and you show him English Channel. He goes, "This is the horse you've been telling me about." Evidently, it didn't fit the mold.
No, he didn't. Frankie Brothers told me that the other day. He said, "How in the hell did you buy that horse?" I don't know myself. Sometimes you just see something in a horse that you like, and you can't get away from it. And you go back and look two or three times, and you go back because nobody else likes them but you, you know. So, who knows?
Well, that's always a good thing. If you're the only one that likes them, usually the price is right.
Yeah, that's for sure.
JJ, let's talk a little bit about what you're doing now. You're in Ocala. You own Peyton Training Center, which is a facility that you spend a lot of time breaking many of the yearlings that Todd trains. Tell me a little bit about what you're up to now and about that training center and your role in Todd's operation today.
You know, I came down here in 85 with a guy by the name of Cloyce Box, who had a lot of money at that time, and he had some land down there. He said, "Let's go down there and build us a training center." And I was tired of being on the racetrack. And so my wife and I loaded up. I had to talk her into it. And we come down here and kind of built a place for Cloyce real close to where I'm at now. And it was there 10 years, and he passed away. When he died, she made me get out, and she's in the real estate, got into real estate. And so she found this piece of property and said, "You got to go back to work." So, so we bought it and started building it. This facility is about smart enough to give Todd half of it, so he had to send me the horses, you know.
Great strategy.
I figured that he was starting to get into the game pretty good. That was in 98 that I bought that, and he started running in 96. I was helping him, but he didn't need any help, come to find out.
Well, that was pretty cagey, making you the number one trainer for the young horses. That was smart on both your parts.
Yeah, like I said, he learned a lot from Wayne and Jeff and them. Those guys, they knew how to handle those young horses, what to do with them.
Well, and that training center named for your oldest grandson, Peyton, as well.
Yeah, that's my pride and joy. I got three grandkids, and he's the first one. So, you know, trouble of it is that he, if the second one come along, Kyle, who I love dearly, he says, "Poppy, how come you named the training center Peyton?" I couldn't come up with a reason other than that he was going to be the only grandchild. There wasn't supposed to be any more. That's the only one they could have. And 13 months later, here comes Kyle, you know. So, goes to show you.
You're going to have to come up with something else to name in honor of Kyle. Maybe the racetrack, maybe a barn.
Well, I made a bad mistake. I had a brood mare too, you know how you do, buy yearlings and stuff. So I named them one after Kyle, one after Hannah. Neither one of them could outrun me, so that was a mistake there.
JJ Pletcher, our special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. JJ, stay with us. We're going to get to a short commercial break. We'll come back and continue this visit on the second half of Trainer Talk. It's all presented by our friends at Fasig Tipton right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
The Fasig Tipton Gulfstream Sale, featuring selected two-year-olds in training. Recent graduates include Kentucky Derby winner Nyquist, Grade 1 Stephen Foster winner Braidster, and Queen's Plate Stakes winner Sir Dudley Diggs. Quality, sire power, and a dirt racetrack. The sale will be held on Wednesday, March 1st at Gulfstream Park at 4 p.m. The Undertack Show will be held on Monday, February 27th. The Fasig Tipton Gulfstream Sale. Premium quality, premier destination. For more information, please visit fasigtipton.com.
Bloom Racing.
Majestic City could also still do it, and here he comes.
Majestic City running a big one.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Soul Driver the leader, though. Soul Driver in front.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best.
Super Saver Ross Amaya, what a finish to the class.
And to stand the best. Windstar Farm. Dedicated to the dream.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
As the Derby field make the turn for home, Noble's Promise has the lead in the Derby. Super Savers towards the inside, staying on is Devil May Care. She is now in third. Paddy O'Prado is staying on. Dublin and Lucky Not Lucky is weaving his way through. Racing now inside the final furlong, it's Calvin Burrell and Super Saver in front. Two in second, Paddy O'Prado down the outside. Icebox is flashing home, racing up to line. Super Saver wins the Derby for top place. Fletcher and for Calvin Burrell. Burrell's third win in the Kentucky Derby. It was Super Saver who held them all at bay and took Kentucky Derby 1:36.
Mark Johnson with the call of that 2010 Run for the Roses Super Saver, getting the victory that afternoon. And as you heard, for Todd Pletcher under jockey Calvin Burrell, a very special day for Todd. He has told that story on this program a couple of times now. And a very special day for his dad, J.J. Pletcher, who is joining us here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Welcome back to our Jimmy Johns of Lexington broadcast studios. Mike Penna, Jude Feld with you on this edition of Trainer Talk. And don't forget, if you missed any portion of this show or all of our shows, you can head back to our website, horseracingradio.net. Check out the podcast at your leisure. Also available on iTunes, Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Fun visit in the first half. Huh? Looking forward to the second half of the program, JT.
Yeah, no, it's been great. A lot of fun and a lot of good stories.
JJ, a little trip down memory lane for you with the call of Super Saver winning the Kentucky Derby back in 2010. I mentioned it was special for your son. Had to be equally as special for you. Tell me about that day.
Oh, man, that was great. It was, that horse came right up the fence. Old Calvin, he's too much, isn't he? he's got that race figured out. I'm glad to see him come back riding. Maybe that'll... he'll do some good. Has he been riding lately? I hadn't kept up with him lately.
Yeah, once in a while. I think it's kind of like hit and miss.
Yeah. I got one story I got to tell. Jude, appreciate this. I went to Santa Anita in, '71. I was going to go out there, and I had an owner who wanted to go out there. And I bought a colt at Keeneland, a TV Lark colt called Janine's Lark. Pretty nice horse, I thought. And so we stayed up, went to Del Mar, didn't do much good, and wound up going back to Oak Lawns, to Oak Tree. I believe it's the first year they run Oak Tree. I run this horse in the Sunny Slope Stakes. And I got Shoemaker to ride him, of all things. That's my claim to fame right there. Harry Silbert, I had to go talk to Harry Silbert. That's like talking to the king, you know, to get Bill to ride this horse. And he won the race, and it was, I want to say 71. It's 71, 72. But I've got the picture, and it was his 500th stakes win. And he was pretty getting up in the years by then. That was how far along he was in his career. And he was still riding and kept riding after that.
Wow.
Yeah. A long time ago.
Yeah. Well, he was a good friend and a great rider, my favorite. I'll never forget the first winner he had for me. And you're right, talking to Harry Silbert, sometimes that could be intimidating. I had a good relationship with him, but one of my favorite Harry Silbert stories, Pat Rogerson, the old columnist for the Daily Racing Form, he wrote one day, a cigar came around the corner, followed closely by Harry Silbert. And he always had that big old stogie in the morning. You'd see the cigar before anything. Yeah. Yeah. Those were good days when Shu was riding.
That was great.
JJ, earlier you talked about being around Mike Smith when he was just getting started with his career, and you talked about being stabled next to Hall of Famer Carl Nafsker. And now you mentioned Bill Shoemaker. You have been so fortunate and so blessed to be around so many of the greatest names in the sport of thoroughbred racing. Tell us about some of the other people that you've been around, that you've befriended over the years for whatever reason, and that you're never going to forget.
You know, another jockey story I have is that I bought a filly with a guy, and she's a two-year-old filly, and I was racing at Oak Lawn, and I sent her out. I owned half of her with the guy, and we sent her out there to run in the Riley Allison Futurity at Sunland Park. like in April. It was a $300,000 race then, which big time. And so we got we're trying to find a jockey, the rider, and Cash Asmussen was there, and he was had already contracted to go to France to start riding. And we talked him into staying and riding that filly on the Sunday, and he was leaving that night to go to France. And she won the race, and we got like $166,000 to the winner. Man, we was high cotton. And that was the last race he rode in the United States before he went to France, and it wasn't a year or two, his leading rider over there, you know. Great jockey.
Yeah, and
good for him too.
Cool guy. Really, really cool guy. What about JJ's Dream? There's even stakes called the JJ's Dream Stakes.
I didn't have anything to do with that. I think guy by the name of John Franks from Louisiana owned that filly, if I remember right.
Yeah.
He was good. I didn't have nothing to do with that. Wish I did.
I always thought that was named after you.
It could have been. I had a lot of dreams.
JJ, tell me about the day in 1980 when you won the Oaklawn Handicap with Uncool. That had to be a very special day.
You want to know something? That horse cost $600 as a weaner. And these guys from New Mexico bought her off of a guy and sent him down to me in Sunland to take with me when I was going to Omaha. The main thing I wanted to do, he was a skinny-looking thing, and so I hauled him with me, too. In the fall of the year, I had him there, and then we went to Oaklawn and was there going to Axe Harbin. He paid $28. And the track come up a little sloppy. He was some horse of Del Carroll's was a favorite in there, if I remember right. But didn't know much, and trouble was I didn't know that I didn't know much. So anyway, we had a lot of good times. Wouldn't trade them.
Well, it was a special day, and the lone graded stakes win of your career with the Thoroughbreds. Obviously, you talked about some of the big races you won with the quarter horses, and now watching your son Todd go on to all this tremendous success, and as a father, you're very, very proud. You talked about that earlier, and I mentioned that at your training center in Ocala, you spend time breaking so many of those young horses before they go on to Todd's operation. You've had a lot of success doing that, JJ. What's the key to being successful when you're working with these young horses?
You just have to be careful with them. And the main thing is we broke quarter horses the same way we do thoroughbreds. You know, you drive them and spend a lot of time on the ground with them, do a lot of riding before you ever go to the track. And that's the key to it to me is to... You're not going to, if you do all your riding in a small pen or round pen for the first 30, 40 days, you're not as apt to get a horse hurt. If you go to hit the racetrack with them too quick, you get the first thing you do, they want to go do too much too quick, you know? I think that's the key to it, spend a lot of time with them and have them where they're broke really well before you try to put any speed into them or anything like that.
Do you start them early?
You know, we try to start them all in September because we always buy most of ours come out of Keeneland sales. And we like to start them, you know, September, October. No later than the 1st of October. You like to have them all started your ground, what we call groundwork with them, you know, driving them and messing with them. In the round pen, I have four round pens. They're 40 foot across and has a high side, and they can't buck you off. They can't pluck one of them boys off and get him hurt or hurt the horse, you know.
You know, JJ,
I don't think you need to start any earlier than that.
Yeah, I was going to say, oftentimes we hear Todd's operation referred to as a program, and that your horse is going through Todd's program. And when you're looking at young horses and then breaking young horses to be sent to Todd, are you doing it in a certain manner that fits his style of training and his quote-unquote program?
Yes. You know what we do that a lot of places don't have? He has about three divisions usually, and I just count our place as a division of his, you know. And we feed the same feed. We buy the feed, comes out of North Dakota, Woody's feed, and we've been buying it for years. And we all of my feed the same as his. And we just can go from one place to the other, it won't be any difference. And we more or less, if I got any problems or need to know anything, I call him up and see what he thinks. He's smarter than I am as far as training horses. He's an expert at it, I'd say.
How often will you talk?
Every day. 5 o'clock every morning. I try to catch him driving. He gets up at 4 and drives to Palm Beach Downs when he's in Florida, South Florida, and I try to call him on the road if I can. Keep him awake.
Yeah, that's good. That means you got to get up at 4 too.
you get old as I am, been doing it as long as I have, you can't help it. You just wake up.
Yeah, there's
no on an alarm clock.
Yeah, no question about that. I know that feeling.
Yeah, we talk every day. And I talk to my grandkids every day too, my two grandsons especially.
What's it like watching them hang out around the operation now?
Oh, I love it. I spend the month of August every year at Saratoga, and Todd gets them up early, and so I meet them at the barn, or I pick them up, and we head for Dunkin' Donuts first thing. I run them through there. Then they start walking hots. They'll walk hots in the mornings now at Saratoga all summer, or all, you know, from the time they get there. They usually get out of school in June, and they have a home in Saratoga, and they go up there, and those boys will work till they go back to school in September.
JJ, do you notice any similarities with the way that Todd is introducing his children to the sport and then the way that you introduced Todd to the sport?
Same thing. they don't have any choice. They got to get into it.
Is the desire there? Do they love it?
Oh yeah, Peyton, the oldest one, does. Kyle's probably too smart to be a horse trainer. He makes too good of grades, chemistry and stuff like that. So he's going to go to engineering school, I think. Peyton just got accepted to Texas A&M, so he's going to go through their program, animal husbandry program, so he'll come out of that and I'm sure go to training horses.
Three generations of Pletchers, the world better watch out.
Yeah, I hope he comes along. He's got the right personality and the right feel for a horse. He's just a natural. He'll shank one pretty good if he needs to, and you know, rides good, they don't have the chance to ride like Todd did when I was training the horses. But they still have the chance to be around it enough to know what they're doing, what's going on, you know.
How about your granddaughter Hannah? Does she want to be involved?
No, she don't. She's not interested in horses at all, hardly. She decided one time she wanted to ride, and her mother took her out to some riding place there on Long Island, and she tried it about a week, and she gave it up pretty quick. I don't think she's another one of them. Her grades are good enough. She don't have to worry about riding.
Maybe Todd needs to buy a Cadillac.
Yeah. Yeah, they've already, those two boys already got a car. You know, one of them's a senior, one of them's a junior. And they, I couldn't have done that for Todd if he'd have wanted one.
Talking with J.J. Pletcher here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. J.J., you've been doing this a long, long time, and you've seen a lot of things come and go in the sport of thoroughbred racing. How much has the game changed, and how has it changed since you first became involved?
To answer that, there's so much more money in the game now than there was when I was starting out in it. And you can make a living training, you know, 10, 15 horses now. I mean, then, yeah, I do now, but back then, I started out quarter horses. I think I was getting $10 a day to train horse, quarter horses, and doing that all the work yourself. Finally got up to thoroughbreds. I was getting 20 for a while, and finally just gradually get enough money to make ends meet, you know. But that's the thing that I see in it now is the money. There's so much money coming into the game now that and that when that money goes coming in, that draws smarter people into the horse industry and smarter, you know, richer people who've got most of them more educated. So it's a lot different game now.
Does it make you nervous at all when you've got one of those million-dollar yearlings at your training center and you gotta watch over them all the time? Is there a different feeling when the horses cost so much money?
It's definitely you watch them a lot closer, and you have to hire. You got to be careful with your employees, because if you're not careful, you get the employees that don't care, and some of them that don't know what they're doing, and sometimes you have to hire some green help, which I do all the time, because you just don't keep good help all the time. And you have to teach them, and you just have to watch continuously. I've got a Irish boy working for me now that's come over from Ireland that does most of the work. I'm getting on up in the years. I don't have to. I go there every day, but my best job is signing checks right now. So, but you have to keep your eye on them all the time, continuously. Help and horses.
JJ, are there any favorites that you've had come through the program over the years? I mentioned English Channel and More Than Ready in the first half of the show. Any that stand out to you and tend to be a little more special?
More Than Ready was one of my favorites. I'll tell you why. That was the first horse we bought for Jim Scatorcio, who's our dear friend. And he, every time when I started breezing that horse, first time I breezed him, I always, you know, start him off in company, you know, pair at a time. He never would let nothing get in front of him. He always had his head in front. He'd be breezing in front. You boys go head and head now. I don't want to know who's going to win. He never would let nobody get in front of him. He was that way from day one. One of my favorite horses.
Yeah, he's...
Never did shin, never shin bucked either. That's what I liked.
he's been just a tremendous sire. My brothers and I actually campaigned his first stakes winner, a filly named Ready to Live, and I have a halter of his hanging in the house that the stallion manager over at Windstar Farm gave me one day. He found out I was a big fan, and he said, "Would you like a halter?" And I said, "I'd love one." He's just an amazing horse. He's had a tremendous career at stud. He was a very good racehorse, and I can see why you have affection for him.
Unbelievable. We was talking, Jim and I, Scott, and I was talking about him a couple of days ago. They said he just goes about his business. Gets 100-something mares every year and flies then to Australia and does the same thing and never misses a beat. Unbelievable.
Anybody else, JJ, that really made an impression on you when they came through the program?
Well, of course, English Channel, you can't miss him. He was such a trier, you know, and so tough. He wasn't very big, and he could run a mile and a half, too. Unbelievable.
You mentioned earlier going to breakfast with Mel and Warren Studi and Henry Marino. Those guys have kind of a little breakfast club. What kind of insights went on at those meetings? Sometimes Wayne Hughes would join in too.
Yeah, Wayne showed up all the time. Every time I see Wayne, we have to talk Warren Studi stories. You know, unbelievable stories. But he always says he tried to beg Warren to buy into his company. He said, "Give me $50,000 and put into this company." And we always laughed out. Warren said, "You're crazy. Ain't nobody got a garage. What do they want a storage unit for? You're crazy."
Yeah, Warren had lots of those opportunities. He didn't take many of them. Clement Hirsch tried to get him into the dog food business. He didn't like that either.
Warren was tough.
He was.
Tough. Good guy, though. Real good guy.
He was tough. He got... One day at San Anita, he got reared up within the starting gate there at the quarter pole, and he got knocked out cold. And, I mean, he just turned every color of the rainbow. I thought he was dead, and I went home, and I said, "I think Warren Studi got killed this morning." And my wife says, "Oh, no, what happened?" And I told her. So I had one in the first race at San Anita, so I showered up and went back to the track. And who's standing at the bar when I get there? Warren Studi in a sharkskin suit. And I mean, it was like I saw a ghost. I go, "I thought you were dead this morning." He says, "Oh, yeah, a lot of people did." He says, "But I feel okay." And he's pounding a drink already. It wasn't even 12:30 yet.
Those guys, him and Mel, both tough guys. Tough guys. We used to have more fun, though, back there to send. That was when the hippies were around, you know, the early 70s and stuff. And some of them long-haired guys would come around looking for a job or something. We'd send them to Warren. Warren Farn. "This guy over there, he'll hire you. Go right over there." You could hear him when they walked up. "Get your out of here, boy." Had a lot of fun doing that.
JJ, who were some of the other people that you kind of were close to throughout much of your career?
You know, those guys and of course, Jack Vandenberg was around all the time. I was always stapled around close to him when I was in Louisiana and Oakland. And the only thing I say about Jack, a good friend of mine too, but I'd have to go at the end of the meet, I'd have to go to his barn and gather up all the stuff that he borrowed off of me. Before he left, he didn't steal it or nothing like that. He'd just borrow it and never bring it back. Knew him real well. Jack was a good guy.
He never would ship brooms either. You'd walk by his barn at the end of the meet and the trash can be full of brooms. He was superstitious. You don't ship brooms to the next venue.
Yeah, Jack, he's funny.
Well, JJ, only a couple of minutes left here before we have to wrap up the program. And when I talked with you yesterday, you said, "Geez, I don't know if I can come up with enough stuff to say for a full hour." But we've done it, my friend, and it's been very, very enjoyable to hear your story. I do want to ask you, though, before I let you go, when you do think about what you've accomplished in your life and your career in the game, and then you see what Todd has been able to do, and that career still, that script is still unwritten, really. What things are you most proud of when you look back on those moments?
Well, one of the nicest things was that we bought Scat Daddy, and Todd and I owned half of him. And we was real smart before the Florida Derby. We sold him for $6 million. So that's where my training center and my house I'm living in and all that came from. We sold him, and then we owned several other small interests in horses that's made money down through the years. The game has been good to us. to Todd and I both that way.
Well, and you've been good to the game as well, my friend, and we can't thank you enough for spending some time with us here, JJ. It's been a delight to visit with you and to hear some of these stories and to talk with you about your son, who is just, in my book, first class. So continued success, and we will look forward to catching up with you at a racetrack very, very soon, my friend.
Well, thank you very much, and I enjoyed it, and I'm very proud of my son, and hopefully I'll be proud of my grandsons.
I'm sure you will. JJ Pletcher with us here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. And boy, what an hour. And if you missed any portion, head back to our website, horseracingradio.net. Check out the podcast. So many great stories. And to hear him talk about his son, his only son, Todd Pletcher, his only child, and to see the way he has developed and what he has accomplished, you can just tell his father is just beaming with pride.
Yeah, well, he mentioned Saratoga and being there with his grandsons and Todd. And I remember one morning we were out waiting to do an interview with Todd for a few minutes, and just saw the four of them together, and they were having a great time. And that's fantastic memories for his grandsons, and I'm sure Todd enjoying it as well.
And you heard him say how Todd is taking the same approach with his children, his sons anyways, getting them involved in the sport the same way his father did, JJ did, when he was growing up.
Yeah, everybody up at four, let's go.
Let's do it. Hey, that's great. Boy, we can't thank JJ Pletcher enough for taking the time here today. And by the way, want to mention that he, like all of our guests who appear on the program, going to receive a gift from Flair Equine Nasal Strips. So we will get those out to him. He can use them on the training center for all those young horses. And boy, going to be great. Fun hour.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
All right, we're back next week. Another all-new Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. Don't forget to check out that Phasic Tipton Florida sale on March 1st with the Under Tack Show coming up couple of days before. For our producer, Lee Delapina, for JJ Pletcher, our special guest, and for Jude Feld, I'm Mike Penn, and we'll talk to you next time on Trainer Talk.